It is time for group. Not everyone joins. I'm not sure what we're doing, but I follow Tamira and the others as we wait outside the cafeteria door. The tables have been folded away, leaving only one out. We pull our chairs to sit around the single small table. I sit next to Ali. Dave pulls his wheelchair next to me. We are told that today we're going to be sharing our autobiographies. How we got here. The monitor is young with a soft voice. He is patient and lets everyone have their turn to speak without interrupting them. He is one of those rare people who actually listens, and it feels like taking a new breath of real air. Okay, folks, so if you don't already know, you need to have a written autobiography to go from involuntary to voluntary. He shows us a form. It reminds me of the writing prompts from elementary school with lines to write on. Your autobiography will go in your files for the doctor to read. Once you have a chance to read your autobiography, you'll get points to get to level 2. If you're already level 2, you'll get extra privileges. The returners shift uncomfortably. They already know the rules of this game. They go around and read their autobiographies out loud. We stare at the floor when someone speaks. It's strange to see people start to take on dimension beyond the identities of race and age and gender. Tamira reads hers without emotion, a childhood of neglect. "I'm a mom," she says. She says the words easily, and I envy her. She's been in the system her entire life. She wants to work on her temper and be a good mom to her kids. She has 2 boys, and so she is excited that she's going to have a daughter. There is Mick, a white veteran who was based in West Germany. He slit his wrists in his sister's house. She checked him in because she didn't want to deal with his bullshit, and he doesn't blame her. He says he's sarcastic, but that he's got a good heart. He's not been allowed a pen, so he's unable to write his down. "Does it count if I'm telling my autobiography?" he asks. "You all won't give me a pen, so does that mean mine won't count?" Dave sits next to me, twirling a pencil in his hands. His scrawl is like that of a child's. I ask him if he wants me to write while he dictates. He looks at me for a moment and then says, "No thanks, Kathy. You concentrate on getting us out of here." I think about my autobiography. How did I get here? How would I begin? Perhaps I would begin with love. When I was 15, my grandmother kissed my cheek and whispered in my ear, "May you never find love." It was a parting gift, like Jacob to his sons. She was trying to protect me. Koreans believe that happiness can only tempt the fates, and that any happiness must be bought with sorrow. As for love, it is thought of as an unfortunate passion, irrational and destructive. Perhaps they believe this out of necessity, to keep stability in a country torn by war and tragedy. Love was best described to me as a hibiscus in our backyard in Kentucky. Korean roses, they were transplants that burned a tropical sunset color. They scampered along the fence in a blaze. The petals were delicate and translucent. The stalks were so thick they would tear and shred as they were cut, shaking the entire fence. To try and cut the blooms for the kitchen table was impossible. They were going to stay right there, not move, even as the sun burned them. Their endurance, the same endurance which made the flowers bloom brightly amongst starved bodies after a winter of war and famine, was what led to their downfall. Strength as weakness. My mother had banished weakness from her world. When my grandmother was pregnant with my mother, she had considered an abortion, but a fortune teller had told her the baby would be a boy. The disappointment of having a 4th daughter in a row meant that my mother was named Gudnam, or the end, the harsh K like the sound of a knife. However, by being born at the end, my mother only pushed forward. I was too weak. I had her features, but softened. My grandmother's warning came too late. I was already fascinated by love and love stories. To me, romantic love seemed essential. I didn't understand how it could be destructive, and I dismissed the warnings as a sign of a repressed culture. I preferred the Western belief in a happy ending. My mother tried to temper my imagination with stories from Korean mythology and cautionary tales. The heroines were always strong, full of piety and sacrifice. There was Shim Chung, who sold herself as a human sacrifice to save her blind father and was rewarded by being reborn in a giant seashell. There was Nonge, a beautiful courtesan who danced an invading Japanese general off a cliff. She wore silver rings on each finger, and she interlaced her hands around his neck to keep him close, to make sure that he went over the edge with her. She laughed as she danced off the cliff, the trees her witness. Romantic love did not feature in these stories. It was an afterthought or a deficiency. Love, instead, was a sacrifice. It meant loss. It meant sorrow. Sacrifice, the giving of oneself completely, that was what was required. That was what was expected. And suffering. As a Korean, I was meant to expect to suffer. My grandparents escaped North Korea at the onset of the Korean War, leaving behind loved ones that they yearned to see for the rest of their lives. It's a common story, the people who fled, leaving behind parents and children, promising to be reunited, not knowing that the borders would close and all communication would be lost. Instead, they were left to yearn, to wait and hope, suspended in the waiting. A border, the 38th parallel. All Koreans know the line of this hemisphere. I used to trace it on the globe as a child. Such a simple line, I'd think, and it had severed so many lives, created such separation. So for Koreans, to love means to mourn, to know loss. The sweetness of love is tempered by the knowledge that life will return with a bitterness to create balance to the story. My psychosis, for all its destruction and wrath, was a love story. It was a story of sacrifice, an obsessive search for my husband. I thought I was Beatrice, the one who was assigned to lead my husband through hell, and that my life was a sacrifice for his. When my brother and I were children, we would count thunderstorms. We would see the flash of lightning and begin counting slowly until we could hear the distant thrum of thunder. We would feel the storm approaching. We could count it into existence and know how many miles away it was, until the storm was upon us and the house and trees would shake in a frenzy of light and sound. I go back to those breaths, that counting, in moments when I can feel something approaching. Perhaps it relieves the expectation, the dread. Perhaps it just reminds me of being a child. I remember counting the waves of contractions like thunderstorms. I was told to walk to encourage labor. It had been 12 hours already since the doctors had started my induction, and labor wasn't progressing. It was before dawn. My husband and I paced the long hallway. It loomed over us like an airplane hangar. I'd count my footsteps until a wave hit me. Then I'd pause and bend over and let it come over me. It felt like my body was a clenched fist, and each contraction moved like a wave that I'd have to accept until it subsided. I could feel the start of the next one, as though it was coming from the horizon. I tried to meet each wave without fear, to deliberately give up control. I could sense that this was beyond my understanding of what my body was capable of. I felt like an instrument, waiting, that deep breath before the first chord of a symphony is played. I was going to be a mother, I thought. I was going to deliver a new life. I couldn't begin to comprehend it. Emma is dancing. She thinks we're at a party. Oh my God, I just want to baila baila, she says. It must be music hour. The workers are playing hip-hop over the speakers again. Dave claps his hands, spinning in his wheelchair while Emma dances. I like your vibe, Emma says to me after a worker tells her to sit down. She brings markers to color next to me while I write. Her mouth is moving like she's chewing gum. We girls have to stick together. Tamira looks at us. I know Emma doesn't mean to include girls like her. I can't believe this place. I swear it's criminal. Emma's voice lowers to a whisper. One of the black guys, he lunged at me. She's talking about Darren, a young black guy who came in looking feral. His first night, he screamed in one of the 24-hour monitored rooms. He's a pacer, too. He sits next to me at the cafeteria mealtimes. He is soft-spoken and calls me ma'am. I feel a sense of protectiveness towards Emma. There's a blind naivety behind her words that sometimes reveals unsettling truths about the ward. Whether she's decrying the unfairness of the workers or how no one seems to be taking us seriously. I wonder if she realizes how uncomfortable she makes the others feel. It is Emma who helps me piece together our status. After tapping on the glass enclosure, insistently shouting, "I'm going to call my avocado," she is handed a stack of paper from one of the workers. We read the papers together in the activity room. Dave has followed us in his wheelchair, listening as I read out loud for Emma. Both of us have blurred vision. I think it's the medication. And so we read slowly. I don't understand, she says, but I think I'm starting to. I learned that we are considered involuntary patients and that we are wards of the state. Am I involuntary? She asks. Yes, I say. I think we both are. I learned that in order to move from involuntary to voluntary, we have to complete a set of levels to prove that we are fit to be released. I then realize why the returners make an effort to keep things polite on the ward. Points are given for friendly behavior, and with those points you can earn privileges, like leaving the ward for outside recreation time. There isn't much about how we get to leave. It says that it is only when the doctors sign off that we will be allowed to leave. Well, Emma collects the papers. I'm getting out of here. Maybe I don't need to wait for an avocado. I like that attitude, Dave says. He nods at me. You're good, paralegal. Until the doctors sign off. I wonder what that means. I look over at Emma, but she's dancing again, twirling around Dave's wheelchair. In the notebook my husband has given me, I draw a family tree. It takes me a few tries, but I manage it. I put myself in the center, Catherine, and then a shaky line to James. I put a box around our names and write London above it. We live in London. Next to James's name, I'm hesitant. I know that he has mother and father. I draw lines to his two brothers, but their faces are blank. It's easier to draw my side of the family. I remember them as I would have when I was a child. My mother, the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. My father, stern, distant, with broad shoulders and glasses that cover his failing eyes. My brother Teddy, a boy with dimples and an easy smile. And then under James and my names, I write Cato in large letters. Baby, son, my son. We chose the name Cato because it meant wisdom. Cato. He was born in November. I know this. Cato has a Korean name as well. Jihun. Two syllables, like all Korean names. The first syllable was chosen by James's family. Ji, meaning wisdom. Hun was my parents' choice, meaning contribution to the community. A wish bestowed from both sides of the family. I write the words I can call myself. I am a daughter, a sister, a wife. Those words come easily. I can remember them. I stare at the page, and then I write mother. The word looks strange next to the others. It stands separate. All these words, they feel inadequate. How do they encapsulate a person? Who is me? Who am I? I feel like my memories are floating around me, distracting me from the present. I'm still trying to contain myself, to bring myself back to the moment, to bring myself back to this space, to this page. I want to be sure I haven't lost myself, because if I have, then maybe I won't be able to find my way back. My father was a maths professor. My mother said she chose him because he was the only man who'd ever been able to look her straight in the face. Because of his bad eyesight, she would say laughingly, he was not overwhelmed by her looks. He did not falter or stumble, like the others who found my mother's beauty too intense. My mother always knew that she was beautiful. She held it around her carelessly. She refused to let it be a weakness or a vanity. It was merely factual. Her beauty was alive, wet and breathing. To look at her was a reminder of one's own mortality. She was all angles, her body stunted from a childhood of malnutrition, and all her energy was pent up in a body too small. She always looked as though she were on the verge of exploding. Her eyes were deeply hooded, brown with a glimmer of gray. So my father had looked my mother straight in the face and persuaded her to move across the Pacific with a promise of loyalty and a smile of straight teeth. She noticed his strong jaw and took his quietness to be strength. While he finished his PhD in the States, he wrote to her every day, long letters of respectful love combined with his views on the world. Her initial appreciation for his devotion became admiration for his convictions, and because he was a maths professor, she knew that things would always be clear, permanent, and proven. She would go back to graduate school in her 40s to study statistics. They moved in together in New Jersey, counting pennies to live on my father's graduate student's salary. My father took many photos of my mother, and she stands in the Polaroid frames, captured in a moment, her hair in the wind, always looking like she's about to leap. They'd watch films at the graduate school cinema and eat boiled peanuts. They would take the bus into New York City to share cheesecake from Little Italy and walk along the waterfront. They would walk hand in hand and dream about the future. My mother wanted children. My father wasn't so sure. It would be 5 years before they decided to have me. By then, my father had found a position as a maths professor at a small university in Kentucky. My father liked the geography, the wide hills and limestone cliffs. The land and southern manners appealed to him. My mother settled in as well. She spent her days watching tapes of BBC drawing room dramas and learned to speak to the Walmart cashiers in perfect BBC tones when they gaped at her for too long. My brother Teddy was born 3 years after me. My mother said she'd planned it that way, but we never knew what that meant. When my mother decided to go back to graduate school, Teddy was left to me most of the time. He was always in the way, but I adored that about him. He was loud and temperamental, and I remember I was the only one who put up with his neediness. I was his Nuna, older sister, as he babbled constantly in Korean. Nuna, Nuna, while he trailed after me. We played outside under the Kentucky sky. In the winter, we built families of snow people, and in the summer, we ran around with lanterns of fireflies at dusk. We made mud pies and carved with toy tool sets under the trees until the shadows crept over and pushed us out. At night, we built bonfires and played with ember sticks, tracing curlicue letters of smoke in the dark. A sensitive child, Teddy cried easily, and, it seemed to me, about everything. He cried when it thundered, if ants got in his socks, if the bonfire burned out too quickly, if he didn't have as much watermelon as I did. He crawled into my room at night with a new nightmare and begged me to tell him stories. I remember our favorite thing was flying a large kite we had got from collecting and sending off coupons on frozen pizza boxes. We lay on the gentle slope of our front yard, and I let him tie the string to his thin wrist, but then tied the end again more securely around mine. The kite soared, what seemed to us beyond the clouds. I've yet to see a kite fly like that again. I told Teddy that it was sure to scrape the sky, and then we'd see the moon. Just keep watching. While I dozed off, he waited and watched, trying not to blink because I'd promised him. Inevitably, he'd fall asleep or think that he'd missed it because he had blinked too much. He never doubted my promises, maybe because I knew what not to promise. I would never promise that he would be safe from my father's temper. Every so often, for no special reason, on a very ordinary day, my father's temper would overcome him. It served as a punctuation to our childhood, a way to cement memory. Without those outbursts, my father was a shadowy figure, a set of rules. It wasn't until I started going to elementary school that we discovered that the rules we had grown up with were unusual. We knew that we weren't allowed a television or radio. "I don't like them," he said. Newspapers were written by liars, and we weren't allowed to read books whose authors hadn't been dead for at least 50 years. "That's how long trash takes to die," he said. I learned to read with a thick copy of Dickens on my lap, while inside was hidden a fantasy novel, or Anne of Green Gables, which he still vetoed because it was shallow. My mother thought these rules were proof of his uniqueness. "See, he doesn't follow other people," she would say. And then, "You know, you two are so lucky. He's the smartest person I've ever met. We should listen to him." But she still watched her BBC dramas, and when he was teaching night classes, she played cassette tapes of Korean pop music that she'd brought over with her years ago. My father would scowl if it was still on when he came home. She'd wink at him and sing a few notes, but she always turned it off quickly. My father kept to himself. He had the whole side of the house that Teddy and I were never allowed into. I'm not sure if this rule was self-imposed or not, but in our minds it was just as forbidden as Bluebeard's lair or the West Wing in Beauty and the Beast. His side of the house was very quiet because he was reading or studying. He never read fiction, although my mother said that he used to, and we knew that he must have from the way he critiqued it. He only read thick textbooks with strange pictures and the occasional Greek texts. Sometimes he banged on the piano, stormy versions of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. He had taught himself painstakingly in college, but the few pieces in his repertoire were faultless. He did a lot of calisthenics, endless push-ups with one hand and jumping jacks, breathing heavily. My mother told us that when he was younger, he had been somewhat weak and overfed, Too bookish. A spoiled family, she said dismissively. But we couldn't imagine that he was ever weak. When my father did come out of his side of the house, it was usually to sit with my mother in the kitchen while she studied. He quizzed her, made her laugh, told her jokes. When we saw him this way, he looked shy, as though he was humbly seeking attention. But he also looked proud that he had earned it. To us, he was very imposing. When he did speak, it sounded like a bark. I've heard rage portrayed as blind, and that's how I would describe the irrationality of his temper and the way he lashed out wildly. But even though it was brutish, my father's anger was a concentrated and calculated one. It was never in my mother's presence, and it was almost always directed at Teddy. My mother went to Lexington for class twice a week. My father picked us up from school on those days. We were never sure which days to expect him because my mother's schedule varied. We would sit quietly in the back, whispering to each other while he played tapes of Bach. Sometimes he told us to speak up and asked what lies our teachers had told us that day. I think he knew we were impressed by his breadth of knowledge, and he'd make us repeat our conversations at dinner for my mother's benefit, so he could demonstrate the way he'd corrected our minds. We were picking Teddy up from kindergarten. He was standing on the corner, neatly waiting with a strawberry lollipop in his mouth. It had already stained his mouth and tongue, and he had a red ring around his lips. My father asked to examine Teddy's lunchbox. He had overheard my mother's lecture that Teddy needed to remember to save the plastic baggies to reuse them, which he often forgot. I knew this was because Teddy had a secret habit of throwing out the bread, picking at everything in the sandwich middle. He didn't like the way our cheap homemade bread went all spongy. Today he had remembered to save the baggies, but had left the two slices of bread inside. Teddy looked worriedly at me, and I smiled anxiously back at him. My father touched the curling bread with one finger. He laughed. Your mother wouldn't be happy. We laughed too, relieved. Teddy started chewing on his lollipop. He smacked his stained lips together, and we giggled at the crunching sounds. Stop that noise, my father barked suddenly. Finish it. Teddy tried to do so quietly, but the candy was too big to swallow. He chewed helplessly. You're not finishing it? You waste your lunch, but eat candy? I wished for the lollipop sound to go away. Why can I still hear it? Ah! My father started screaming. He cursed in English. He reached back and found my brother's hair and pulled as hard as he could. The Honda was speeding on bluegrass. We sat calmly and tried not to breathe. I held out a tissue for my brother to spit out the candy. He did it quietly. It looked like red splinters in my palm. There was silence. And then again, what? What? My father's right hand was off the wheel, and it groped behind him. Knowing what was coming, my brother moved his legs for easy access, because at least then the car wouldn't veer. He was a little too late, though. Are you dodging me? Eh? No, no, look how easy, we thought. Teddy dangled his scraped legs readily in reach. He blinked at me with big eyes, his scalp red from the tugging and his shirt a little disheveled. I sat on my legs so they weren't in the way. By the time we arrived home, my father was still seething. He shut the car door without looking at us and slammed into the house. What happened next was routine. Teddy would wait with me in my room and we would try to be quiet. My father sat in his west wing, and we would just wait. I hated this most, the silence. Sometimes he would call Teddy in, and I would hear the pull and scrape and beat of fists and unclenched slaps. By this time, there would be no yelling. Our father would be quiet, concentrated, and very thorough. He was a mathematician, so it was always very rhythmic. Sometimes I thought I heard patterns. By dinner time, my father would be almost jovial. He'd make sure to serve us seconds to spare my mother having to get up and sit down. He'd make jokes and laugh hysterically, tousling Teddy's hair. My mother would beam, pleased, but we knew. Big eyes stared at plates. We never said anything to our mother, I think because we hated it even more when she fought with him, and they fought a lot already. Mostly she was the one who started the fights because she couldn't take his silences or his sulking moods anymore. She would scream and use words in Korean that we didn't know, and words in English that we didn't know that she knew. Her anger was very dramatic. She screamed and threw things, and my father would sit silently and take it. Once, when he left the house in the dark, he looked like he was about to sob. This was worse, we thought. Not him leaving, but my mother's drained look and coldness afterwards. She would then lecture us on how lucky we were to have him. "Your father gives up so much for you," she'd say. And we weren't sure if it was a self-reminder, but she looked angrily at us until we felt ungrateful and undeserving. These fights always ended well, inevitably with my father coming back and trying to apologize. My mother wouldn't acknowledge him, or she would curse indirectly at him for a few more hours, while he waited bashfully. But in the end, she would smile and let him lean against her. I never understood my father's anger against Teddy. A part of me wondered if it was jealousy. Perhaps he had expectations for Teddy because he was a son, or perhaps it was because Teddy was so clearly our mother's son, with his moon-shaped eyes and high cheekbones. There was something there, a shadow of something, an echo I couldn't recognize. It wasn't my father's intention that I would become fascinated by literature and words. I think he hoped that I would turn to numbers, to certainty, but I loved stories. And so I grew up reading Greek mythologies and many of the classics I was too young for and couldn't really follow. My father wanted his children to be clean thinkers, unpolluted by commercialism. He had a vision of raising us apart from the world, off the grid, away from any pre-dictated rules except his own. We learned not to talk about school or pop culture nonsense. It was stifling, but we accepted it because there was no alternative. I'd lie on the hammock under the oak tree and dream. Dream of the sky, dream of escape, dream of air. My father started to lose his eyesight when we were still children. It was devastating for him, a scholar. We tried to be sympathetic, to be less afraid, but it was like trying to learn not to be afraid of a wolf that we are told has no teeth. Teddy and I lived in silence so as not to bother my father. We learned to move as though we were in a library, out of the way. We spoke softly, in whispers, and any words were deliberately chosen. Teddy and I could communicate with just a slight nod of the head, a movement of the hands. People called Teddy and me foxhole buddies, which was an accurate description. It was just the two of us. When Teddy quit his job after university and packed a backpack with a tent to travel around the world, I understood. "I can't explain," he said to me. "I just felt like I couldn't breathe." I knew what he meant. I had felt that feeling of suffocation, the need to walk. I'd often felt the same, staring at the sky, wondering what lay beyond. It was why I'd chosen New York for university. I'd wanted to go somewhere anonymous, a place that was boundless, a place where I wouldn't feel closed in. And sometimes I'd feel that call, especially in the summer, when the wind was blowing through the windows and the sun was setting between the silver of the buildings. I'd walk until the sun faded and it turned to night, and I'd howl against the wind. I remember this feeling now as I walk through the ward, trying to shuffle deliberately along the linoleum floor. Teddy is the first person I call from the ward. There is a payphone in the hallway, and I lift the receiver, but there is no dial tone. I hold it uncertainly. "You have to tell them to turn it on," Randy says to me. Randy is developmentally disabled. He's one of the residents who don't count their time here. He walks with his hands brushing against the walls, sometimes chuckling to himself, and then every so often, he steps inside the activity room and screams. I stand by the glass. Randy helpfully raps on the glass for me. "Phone's not on," he shouts, "and it's time for the phone to come on, about 10 minutes ago." They ignore us, but Randy tells me to go check the phone, and there's now a dial tone. I don't have any quarters, so I make a reverse charge call. It takes me several tries to get it right. Teddy's is the first number that I can remember. "Catherine," I say to the operator, and then I wait. "Hello?" My brother's voice is calm, reassuring, familiar. "Nuna?" I take a deep breath. "Hi," I say. I pause. I don't know where to begin. "I'm glad you called. I didn't know you had access to a phone there." "There." Neither of us say where I'm calling from. I have a vague memory of the last time I spoke to him. I was pleading, asking him to turn off the simulation, and he was telling me to be calm, to listen to James. "Yes, they have a payphone here." "How are you?" He seems to falter. "I'm okay," I say. Have you spoken to James? James, yes, my husband. No, I say. Wait, give me your number, and I'll tell James to call you. He hangs up quickly and leaves me with the sound of the dial. I feel lost for a moment, and I don't know what to do, so I hang up. I have a feeling of being alone, but I push it aside. There is no phone call from James. As I soon learn, once the phone is turned on, it is almost constantly in use. We sit in the TV room, waiting expectantly for the phone to ring, and once it does, one of us will rush in our padded socks to answer it. Phone, they shout. I wait for someone to call my name. After my mother graduated, we moved to the suburbs of Washington, D.C. and Virginia without much explanation or warning. I was about to start high school. Teddy had just finished fifth grade. My mother had found a job with the federal government in a tall marble building with a view of the Capitol. My father would stay behind in Kentucky. My mother looked regretfully at our backyard, and Teddy mourned his collection of limestone fossils. We piled our belongings into a car and drove. We moved into a furnished apartment owned by a Russian lady who'd filled her home with china cabinets and orange tapestries. My mother held my father's hand as she drove us to Virginia. There wasn't much talk about what they would do. He visited us every month, sometimes as often as every other weekend. The apartment wasn't large enough for him to have his own area, so he sat silently on the sofa, and we would stay in our rooms. By the time I went to university, my father's eyesight had stabilized. He could see enough to walk, but he couldn't see faces, and he wasn't able to travel on his own. I never heard him complain. He didn't use a cane, and instead walked carefully, holding my mother's hand. He still played the piano, learning each piece note by note. He'd pause to hold the sheet of paper to his face so that he could read the music. I went to university in New York. I felt strange leaving Teddy behind. My family drove up with me to the dorm. Teddy carried the boxes of my things. He was much taller than me. He was no longer the sensitive boy who cried about the last piece of watermelon. Instead, I was the one to cry, while he stood stiffly and looked uncertain. When he turned to leave, I saw on his face that used to be my mother's face, the outline and shadow of my father's jaw. Some summers, Teddy would come up to spend weeks with me in the city. He'd appear with a large suitcase and crash at my apartment, sleeping on an air futon at the foot of my bed. During term, I called him every day, and we'd talk about his day, about school. My father was spending more time in Virginia, but my brother never talked about him. Teddy would go to university in Chicago, and somehow I wasn't surprised when he told me that he would be studying mathematics. When Teddy decided to walk away from his job and go traveling, he was gone for nearly 2 years. He sold all his possessions and started to walk. He made his way across Asia, Europe, parts of Africa, and then finally to South America. He hiked mountains and deserts, walking along remote paths. He would call me whenever he had access to a phone, and he always sounded breathless with excitement and wonder. He took videos of his travels around the world. I'd watch him and think there was something restrained in the way he carried himself, but sometimes I thought I saw a hint of the kid brother I knew, a young boy with dimples who loved to laugh. When I think of Teddy, I think of us playing in the trees during thunderstorm season, in the yellow calm when the storm is about to hit. We are in the oak tree, the one with the shaky third branch. Teddy sits where the branches begin to spread, the tree's heart. He's wearing green corduroy trousers, the ones I loved and reluctantly handed down. I'm waiting on the first branch because I know I'll have to help him get down. The Kentucky air smells like bourbon, and we can hear the storm and thunder that's about to come. Please don't cry this time, I tell him. He pretends not to hear me, but nods. We wait as long as we can, shaking in anticipation as the sky changes and the trees around us turn gray. Our mother calls us in, and I help him down so that we can run to the house before the downpour. I hear one of the workers say that it's been raining. I can see droplets of water caught in her hair. We can't tell what the weather is like. The curtains are always drawn, and the windows are small and frosted over. In the television room, the window that's kept ajar has been shut. I try and remember what it feels like to stand in the rain, to feel something other than fluorescent lighting. The TV is turned to Olympics coverage all day. It's taking place in Pyeongchang, South Korea, a show of symbolic unity. The first time a unified Korea is hosting the Olympics. Korea, Tamira says in a slow whisper. She says it with a meaningful tone and looks at me, as though I'm the ambassador for the Olympics. I wonder if I'm being paranoid, but I'm not sure what she's trying to imply. Maybe she knows that I feel like the television is speaking to me. I know I must be imagining it, but the ads feel too accurate, and the Olympic coverage in Korea is the same way. I tried to hide my expression when I hear her. You have to go to your room again? She asks with a sly smile. I think she's guessed that I have to go to my room to express milk. Mama, mama, she says, and laughs. I keep my face blank and give her a smile before I leave the room. Behind me, I hear the sound of whispering. What are they saying? Is it about me? I try to breathe. I was born in the year of the tiger. I have to survive. I think of my grandmother. She was born in the year of the tiger like me. We are 60 years apart. According to Koreans, you live a whole life cycle in 60 years. And tigers are guardians in Korean folklore, symbols of courage and strength. I will be okay, I think. I keep my head up when I walk and make sure to look behind me before I enter my room. The door closes heavily. I glance around to make sure nobody is there and then step inside the curtain that separates the bathroom. I try to express milk as quickly as possible. It hurts to touch my breasts. They are swollen and red. The strips of cotton wool in my shirt are soaked through, and I throw them away and replace them with new cotton. I try to hurry. I wonder what I would do if someone tried to come in. I don't know why, but the thought makes me feel nauseous. I think only Tamira has guessed that I have a baby, that I'm a mother, and I want it to stay that way. I straighten my clothing and make sure there aren't any stains when I walk back outside. I sense that there is tension in the ward. Emma feels it too. Gosh, it feels hostile, she says. The television room is occupied by the Hispanics and the whites. The black residents are roaming outside, looking in and talking in low voices amongst themselves. Break it up, the workers say. Their voices get high-pitched when they start to feel nervous. I notice it. Ali glances at me. I keep my eyes on my notebook. I press my pen on the paper so hard it tears. Year of the Tiger, I think. We saw my grandmother every summer. We would go to Korea every year to stay at my grandfather's missionary compound. He was my father's father, a minister, and he'd built a church and house on a hill for the missionaries to stay in. The days were long and hot, with the occasional outpouring of rain. There was no thunder or lightning, just the storm and the wet. But for 1 week of our visit, we'd take the train from Seoul down to Busan to visit my mother's mother. Her apartment was located by the central markets, next to the fish market and clothes shops, under the shadow of a tall mountain. There was the constant noise of the marketplace, the voices from the streets, and the flicker of fluorescent neon lighting. My grandmother's apartment was small, with bamboo furniture and mother-of-pearl cabinets finished in filigree cranes and cherry blossoms. She had a fish tank full of tiny fish, guppies and goldfish, and fish that gleamed silver. It's for good luck, she said. I meant to be by the water. She'd grown up on an island, Dog Island, battered by waves. She'd grown up shaped by the sea. It was the threat of Japanese soldiers that caused my grandmother to get married. The unmarried girls were the unlucky ones. They became comfort women, taken from their homes against their will. My grandmother had married a mainlander. My grandfather was handsome, older, with dark hair and high cheekbones. He was a tailor. During the day, he sewed carefully cut suits. At night, he would drink too much rice wine and smoke cigarettes with his friends. They had settled in Busan, a city by the coast, and my grandmother kept fish and planted flowers and looked to the horizon and thought of her island home. Every visit, we would go to my grandfather's grave. We would visit on a day when there was no rain, so the roads would be clear of mud. My grandmother would come with us, quietly holding a bottle of rice wine. My grandfather's grave was on a hill, where graves were built into the sides of the mountain overlooking the city. My uncle poured the rice wine over the gravestone. We laid out the fruits on a cloth. I remember the colors of the apples and pears tumbling onto the ground. We took off our shoes and bowed, pressing our foreheads down to the earth. My mother disapproved of superstition, and she didn't let us burn the paper money or incense in the communal offering, but she didn't say anything when my uncle told us to empty our pockets so that the dead wouldn't follow us. After our offering, we walked down to the car and shook the sand from our shoes. Behind us, the graves loomed. We drove to a bakery where we ate red bean shaved ice, paper parasols floating in the sweet condensed milk. My mother cut the fruit from the grave, long curls of apple and pear falling from her knife, and we listened to the sound of the ocean. Emma has folded a piece of paper into a fortune teller, like the ones we used to have at school. Folded peaks of paper with little fortunes written inside. Dave claps his hands. Do mine, he says, while she tries to remember how to move her hands. I notice that the fortunes inside are blank. She's only colored them in. Pick a color, she tells me. Blue, I say. Blue, okay, she pauses. B-L-U-E. She lifts the piece of blue-colored paper. She tells me that I will get married and have lots of kids. She's already married, Tamira says. Oh, Emma says. I look down at my hands. There's no wedding ring there. I was 22 when I fell in love with the wrong man. It was the summer after I graduated from university. I'd got a job in New York at a corporate law firm with a marble-floored lobby and a soaring office with floor-to-ceiling glass. I had just moved into a new apartment. I was paying off my student loans, and I was living in a city I loved. I knew I was supposed to feel happy, or at least content, but I couldn't help feeling like a fraud. The finance industry was collapsing, banks were declaring bankruptcy, and in the general hysteria, paperwork kept pouring in. I was working until early dawn every morning, and while I was happy with the overtime pay, the majority of my work was standing by the photocopier, and I felt like I was caught in a never-ending machine. We were supposed to write hourly summaries of our work in order to bill clients. We had spent several weeks being trained to perfect the art of writing succinctly but with description. I never knew how to write 5 hours of photocopying in a sufficiently colorful way, and I was always being sent emails requesting that I rewrite them. Keeping track of each hour made me feel anxious. My entire day condensed into neat catalogs of photocopying, collating, redacting. It made me think of the headstones in St. John's Cathedral, a graveyard I walked through every morning to go to work, lives condensed into 3 chiseled lines. Drew represented possibility, a dare against what was certain. He was visiting New York from Hong Kong. He'd had a long-term girlfriend before we met. He was said to be a generous friend and a gentleman. All in all, a very good guy. He was a friend of a friend. We met at a party. I had never been very sure about the description of a good guy. In my experience, the good guys turned out to be the ones you had to be most careful around, but Drew played to the mold very carefully. He was, in his words, a family man who adored his parents more than anything. He told me that he was very loyal, a one-woman man, he'd said with a shrug. He had recently broken up with his girlfriend because he felt she was too dependent on him. Drew was convincing in the role of a gentleman. He was charming. He was sweet and sensitive. He was an easy person to get along with, and everywhere we went, he was followed by a posse of friends. He wanted to introduce me to everyone. It was a whirl of parties and introductions. "Meet the girl who's changed my life," he'd say. They would always smile at me and say, "Drew is a really great guy. He's a really good guy. He's a great friend. He's very honest. It's hard to find that nowadays. He's a really good guy." And I would nod and smile happily. How lucky I was to have met someone so genuine. I never wondered why so many people had to qualify that Drew was a good guy to me. If I had been paying attention, I should have realized that it was a warning. We spent several months together, and when he left, I was convinced that I'd found someone who truly loved me. Even long distance, he was devoted, phone calls, visits, and each time he begged me to move to Hong Kong. He told me he needed me, that I would be able to find a job. "I could take care of you," he said. He seemed to like that thought. "I want you to need me more." It was a strange request. He started enlisting his mother's help. His mother was named Leah, a querulous woman who was devoted to him. "My son loves you so much," she said. "He needs you here." Hong Kong was a mysterious place, and increasingly it represented freedom from the traps of New York. I handed in my notice at work and decided to leap. I arrived in Hong Kong on the day before New Year's Eve. It seemed significant. The entire city was draped in paper and tinsel. There were lights dangling from buildings, figurines of snowmen, and silhouettes of dancing candy canes that would light up several stories high, blinking in a swarm of red and green. A year later, I was left out on the balcony of our flat. The air was damp from the nearby ocean, and the chill was a kind that settled in your skin. I was on the balcony floor, wearing only a pair of socks, mismatched cartoon animal socks that somehow Drew had forgotten to drag off me before he'd pushed me outside. I was shivering, holding my legs with my back pressed against the glass door. My skin was stuck to the glass, to the bareness of the granite ground, stuck even to the night air. By that New Year's, I had finally known the truth. There had been many incidents before Leah would tell me he had been this way before. My face was clean. There were no marks on it, but there was a mark on my neck from where he'd held the blunt knife to it, the knife I used to peel apples the way my mother did, in one long, crisp curl. He'd used a belt. He'd paused in the middle to find a thicker one that had a more satisfying snap, and my arm had a bruise from shoulder to elbow and angry welts along my abdomen. It never started the same way. Unlike my father's anger, Drew's was unpredictable, triggered by anything, by nothing. His rage was superficial, circumstantial. Someone had looked at me for too long, and I liked it. His boss didn't give him a raise, and I wasn't sympathetic. I nagged too much. I didn't understand him. I was being too confrontational. And then after a while, he stopped justifying it. He must have realized that he didn't need to. It angered me. I had never thought I would be a battered woman, and I didn't think of myself that way. I thought of our relationship as complicated. Drew loved me. He loved me so much, and I was difficult. I didn't know how to make it stop. No matter what I did, if I argued, if I didn't argue, if I fought back, if I let it happen, it didn't seem to matter. And so I stayed with him and hoped, as he promised me each time, that he would change, that he would become a better man. I enrolled in law school and took classes in the university on the hill. After class, I would take the minibuses that zipped along the mountainsides to tutor expat children. On the weekends, we would dress for parties, glittering nights of too much alcohol and stale cigarettes. That evening, Drew had been unhappy about the way I'd laughed at a joke a friend had made about him. When we came home, he was sullen. I could sense the storm was coming. I counted slowly, waiting for the descent. Why did I laugh at that joke? I always laughed at him. I never gave him face in front of his friends, he said. Didn't I understand how hard it was for him? How difficult? His rage circled. It gained momentum. And then it started, sharply at first, the opening. On the balcony, the air glittered with an unknown dust. The sky wasn't dark, but a strange milky orange and gray. It was like colored mist. I wondered if I should jump off the balcony, silently leaping and turning into this orange night. I couldn't help wincing as I imagined my body naked and sprawling lopsided on the pavement, the cartoon socks. Behind me, through the glass door, I could hear Drew pacing the apartment, and as I feared, his rage hadn't subsided. He pulled me in again. He was stomping on my face. There was a belt, and then another, and another. They weren't heavy enough, he was shouting. He was stomping on my stomach, stomping on my legs. I could feel his fist on my face. He was straddling me and punching me again and again on the same side of my face. I was lying on the floor, and as I turned my head, I could see in the mirror something I didn't recognize. It looked like putty, putty with eyes. It couldn't be right. Was that my face? I wasn't screaming. I wasn't crying. I was just drifting in and out of consciousness. I fainted. I saw my parents. I saw my brother. I saw New York streets with the sunset pouring through. I was wearing a linen dress, sharing popsicles at recess with a boy I grew up with. I was catching summer fireflies in my palm, watching them light up, dancing with them like baubles. And then I saw Drew's face again, shaking and shaking me. Wake up. He was shaking my head so hard it was bumping on the tile floor. He thought he'd killed me, and he was panicking. When I opened my eyes, I thought I saw him feel relief, but then he punched me again. I passed out. I went to the hospital. I had a fissure on one cheekbone, and my face was so bruised it looked like it was smeared. Leah was sobbing when I told her. "I don't know why he does this," she said. "Why? Why does he do this?" And then she told me about the first time she'd confronted him. It was years ago. He and his girlfriend had been out, and she had come back with bruises on her arms and legs. Their friends said that Drew had been drinking. Leah said she had confronted him. She hadn't raised her son this way. She screamed. She wept. His response was to sit on the balcony ledge, looking out to the faint lines of the ocean, his legs over the sides. He sat there for many minutes, maybe even an hour, she wasn't sure. It was the worst day of her life, she said. She said she never brought up violence with him again. I thought of all those times that she'd advised me to be kinder, more patient, to be more understanding. This was her son. This was her monster. I knew it was unfair to blame her, but I took all my frustration and directed it at her. I left one night. It was 7 months after the incident on the balcony. I left with only my wallet and phone, dressed in sandals and a thin nightdress. I'd finally realized that Drew did not love me, had never loved me. I wish I could say that it was because of one momentous incident, but it wasn't. I had discovered that Drew was texting his old girlfriend. He'd saved her name under an alias, a boy's name that I didn't recognize. I felt disgusted, cheated. Everything I'd suffered, I thought of as a sacrifice, a willing gift to someone in return for the love they gave to me. I'd never thought of the possibility that there was no love here. The certainty I thought I'd found was merely entitlement, and without it, I was left with a shadowy, weak pretense of a person. The idea was liberating, but for the first time, I was truly afraid. All these months of violence, what if he killed me now, when I'd finally realized the truth? I'd tried to break up with him, thinking that he'd be relieved. He'd slapped me hard across the face. It had triggered several days of him not letting me out of the apartment, and I knew that if I wanted to leave, I would have to do it quietly. "I'm going to go downstairs quickly," I said pleasantly. I couldn't hear anything except the sound of my heartbeat. Would it work? He was lying in bed, his face in shadow, and he shrugged. I closed the door without looking behind me, and I walked slowly, calmly, 5 steps to the lift. I pressed the button. I waited, tense to hear if the door behind me would open. Would he watch me leave? Would he come out? The lift came at last, and I pressed the button softly and prayed for the doors to close. I walked out of the lobby into the crowd of people still partying on the streets. I kept walking without looking behind me. I kept walking into the crowd until I was certain no one would follow. I counted my footsteps. 1, 20, 50, 100. How many would it take? I passed an alleyway I'd been beaten in. I passed the night markets with roast ducks in the window, the shop of the medicine man who served turtle, the bakery with yellow moon egg tarts in the window. I could feel the night air press around me, but I felt nothing. I felt that I'd just walked out of a glass case. I had been able to leave all along, I just hadn't realized it. Everything had shattered around me, and Drew was now like a poison in my lungs. But in order to leave, I had to take the infected part with me as well. The night was running with me. I kept walking. I was leaving. I was free. I stayed in Hong Kong to finish my course. During weekends, I spent my time searching for air. I walked around the city. I felt like I was being preserved in camphor, the gases and the pollution a haze around me. I felt dull. I couldn't remember what a vibrant sky looked like. I walked the back routes of the city and let myself get lost. I listened to the air, the stiff sound of fabric in the market shops, walked past the men saucing ducks and hanging them glazed, upside down in the windows, contorted around a hook. The shops of woodblock stamps, manuscript paper the size of bedsheets. I spoke to my mother every morning. I think she had a sense that something was wrong. I told her that Drew and I had broken up, but I didn't tell her why. She wanted to know why I wouldn't come home, but I told her that I wanted to finish my degree, and she didn't question me. I was drinking too much. I'd drink until I couldn't see anything or feel anything anymore. I drank until I wasn't afraid. Some nights I'd wake up in the hospital with an IV of fluids in my arm, and I'd call a taxi to drive me back to the small apartment I was staying in, hiding from Drew. He never came to find me at my classes, even though I was scared that he would. I thought he had let me go, or maybe he thought I would go back to him and he was waiting. I didn't know. I tried my best to disappear. The last time I spoke to Leah, she wanted to know where I was living, but I wouldn't give her my address. I knew she would just give it to Drew. "Please," she said. "Drew loves you." "I don't think he does," I said. "And I can't be with him anymore. He hits me." I said it flatly. She paused. "I know he's not perfect," she said, "but I really think with time, you both can work it out. You didn't argue so much with him." I interrupted. "I did everything. It never worked. It's just who he is." It was as if I had slapped her. How dare I suggest that he would never change? He was her son. She took a deep breath. She said softly, "I hope you change your mind." I wouldn't. I knew this, but I said nothing. There was nothing to say. On my last week in Hong Kong, a week after term ended, I packed up my belongings and bought a one-way ticket back to my parents' house in Virginia. It felt like a defeat, like I was starting again in a place I thought I'd left behind. For my last week, I decided to take a hike called the Walk of 1,000 Steps. The route followed a mountainous path along the edge of Hong Kong. You could see the sharp edges of the buildings and the ocean underneath. Each hill would lead to a valley, and then to another hill, curved like a dragon's back. At the midway point of the hike were the 1,000 Steps, a series of stone stairs carved into the mountain. There were no trees, only land, and I wished for wind. The heat was hands pressing on me. I wished that as I walked, my memory would be erased, that each footstep would take me closer to another place, another reality far away from the one I knew. I wasn't even halfway when I lost count of my steps. I felt like I couldn't breathe. My breath was gone. I couldn't do it. I couldn't finish the climb. Below me, I could see the silver gray of the buildings, sharply outlined like shards of glass, and the ocean laid out like the sky. It was like looking at an upside-down world. There, I thought, there was the place of anger and pain. I wasn't able to escape it. I turned around and descended, back to the polluted air, back to the mist. Emma's fortune tellers are all over the activity room, discarded, half-folded, and opened in different colors, but all are blank, no fortunes. It was a fortune teller who had told my grandmother that my mother would be a son, ensuring her survival. I imagined the fortune teller hunched over books, reading numbers and thumbing through calendars, counting the alignment of the stars, and saying, "Yes, yes, your prayers have been answered. This one will be a son." I remember the fortune-seeking boats in Hong Kong. The fortune-seeking boats promise good fortune, all for a generous fee. I learned that it wasn't only for good fortune, but also to absolve sins. And so there were often triad bosses, dressed in black suits, counting out stacks of cash bills. The sellers waited by the harbor with tubs of silver fish to be released into the ocean. There would be men and women, sometimes grandmothers, leaning over the tubs, pressing money into the sellers' hands. You could tell who had the most sins to absolve. They bought octopus, the most expensive offering. The sellers would stand quietly, and the pilgrims would board the boats with the tubs of fish in their hands. The boat would putter out into the harbor, to around the midway point, and there would be the sounds of chanting echoing over the water. They would empty the tubs into the ocean, letting the fish swim free, granting life, finding good fortune. The streams of fish fell in waves into the water. There were clever fishermen who waded in small boats to re-catch them. But I love the idea of absolving sins through granting life. I wonder how they felt, the fortune seekers, looking out to the horizon, wishing their bad luck away. What would I ask a fortune teller now? How could I wish my bad luck away? I imagined standing on a boat. I would be facing the harbor, feeling the salt air in my face, watching as streams of silver fish fell into the water, promising absolution. "You will have good luck today," Emma tells Dave. "Damn right," he says. "Damn right. Do mine again."